Section 2, Going to War in Vietnam. An American Story. Marlene Grimmel joined the Army Nurse Corps in 1965 when she was 21, and she went to Vietnam the following year. She was working in a makeshift hospital on what was a particularly quiet night. Most of the patients who filled the beds that evening were suffering from malaria. Suddenly, a row of helicopters roared in from over the horizon, carrying wounded from a nearby battle. As the casualties came in on stretchers, the hospital turned chaotic. Doctors ran about the facility screaming orders and frantically trying to treat patients. The only nurse on duty at the time, Grimmel felt overwhelmed by the confusion. "Every one of the doctors is yelling for me," she recalled. "I didn't know what to do next. Start this, do that. Everybody's yelling at me. I couldn't do enough." Things happened so quickly that night, she insisted, that she could not remember most of it. "I can't remember blood, even. I can only remember, what am I going to do? And the doctor's moving at tremendous speed. And I'm there, and I'm not able to move fast enough. That's all I remember." Adapted from The Living and the Dead. American Involvement Deepens. The steps that led to the chaos and casualties Marlene Grimmel experienced in 1966 began in the mid-1950s, when American officials decided to support the government of South Vietnam in its struggle against North Vietnam. After Ngo Dinh Diem refused to hold national elections, Ho Chi Minh and his followers began an armed struggle to reunify the nation. They organized a new guerrilla army, which became known as the Viet Cong. As fighting began between the Viet Cong and South Vietnam's forces, President Eisenhower increased American aid and sent hundreds of military advisors to train South Vietnam's army. Despite the American assistance, the Viet Cong continued to grow more powerful, in part because many Vietnamese opposed Diem's government, and in part because of the Viet Cong's use of terror. By 1961, the Viet Cong had assassinated thousands of government officials and established control over much of the countryside. In response, Diem looked increasingly to the United States to keep South Vietnam from collapsing. Kennedy takes over. On taking office in 1961, President Kennedy continued the nation's policy of support for South Vietnam. Like Presidents Truman and Eisenhower before him, Kennedy saw the Southeast Asian country as vitally important in the battle against communism. In political terms, Kennedy needed to appear tough on communism, since Republicans often accused Democrats of having lost China to communism during the Truman administration. Kennedy's administration sharply increased military aid and sent more advisors to Vietnam. From 1961 to late 1963, the number of American military personnel in South Vietnam jumped from 1,364 to around 15,000. American officials believed the Viet Cong continued to grow because Diem's government was unpopular and corrupt. They urged him to create a more democratic government and to introduce reforms to help Vietnam's peasants. Diem introduced some limited reforms, but they had little effect. One program Diem introduced at the urging of American advisors made the situation worse. The South Vietnamese created special fortified villages known as strategic hamlets. These villages were protected by machine guns, bunkers, trenches, and barbed wire. Vietnamese officials then moved villagers to the strategic hamlets, partly to protect them from the Viet Cong and partly to prevent them from giving aid to the Viet Cong. The program proved to be extremely unpopular. Many peasants resented being uprooted from their villages, where they had worked to build farms and where many of their ancestors lay buried. The overthrow of Diem. Diem made himself even more unpopular by discriminating against Buddhism, one of the country's most widely practiced religions. In the spring of 1963, Diem, a Catholic, banned the traditional religious flags for Buddha's birthday. When Buddhists took to the streets in protest, Diem's police killed 9 people and injured 14 others. In the demonstrations that followed, a Buddhist monk set himself on fire, the first of several to do so. The photograph of his self-destruction appeared on television and on the front pages of newspapers around the world. It was a stark symbol of the opposition to Diem. In August 1963, American Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge arrived in Vietnam. He quickly learned that Diem's unpopularity had so alarmed several Vietnamese generals that they were plotting to overthrow him. When Lodge expressed American sympathy for their cause, the generals launched a military coup. They seized power on November 1, 1963, and executed Diem shortly afterward. Diem's overthrow only made matters worse. Despite his unpopularity with some Vietnamese, Diem had been a respected nationalist and a capable administrator. After his death, South Vietnam's government grew increasingly weak and unstable. The United States became even more deeply involved in order to prop up the weak South Vietnamese government. Coincidentally, 3 weeks after Diem's death, President Kennedy was also assassinated. The presidency, as well as the growing problem of Vietnam, now belonged to Kennedy's vice president, Lyndon Johnson. Reading check. Examining. What was the main goal of the Viet Cong? Johnson and Vietnam. Initially, President Johnson exercised caution and restraint regarding the conflict in Vietnam. "We seek no wider war," he repeatedly promised. At the same time, Johnson was determined to prevent South Vietnam from becoming communist. "The battle against communism," he declared shortly before becoming president, "must be joined with strength and determination." Politics also played a role in Johnson's Vietnam policy. Like Kennedy, Johnson remembered that many Republicans blamed the Truman administration for the fall of China to communism in 1949. Should the Democrats also lose Vietnam, Johnson feared it might cause a mean and destructive debate that would shatter my presidency, kill my administration, and damage our democracy. Turning point. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. On August 2, 1964, President Johnson announced that North Vietnamese torpedo boats had fired on two American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. 2 days later, the president reported that another similar attack had taken place. Johnson was campaigning for the presidency and was very sensitive to accusations of being soft on communism. He insisted that North Vietnam's attacks were unprovoked and immediately ordered American aircraft to attack North Vietnamese ships and naval facilities. Johnson did not reveal that the American warships had been helping the South Vietnamese conduct electronic spying and commando raids against North Vietnam. Johnson then asked Congress to authorize the use of force to defend American forces. Congress agreed to Johnson's request with little debate. Most members of Congress agreed with Republican Representative Ross Adair of Indiana, who defiantly declared, "The American flag has been fired upon. We will not and cannot tolerate such things." On August 7, 1964, the Senate and House passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, authorizing the president to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. With only 2 dissenting votes, Congress had, in effect, handed its war powers over to the president. The United States sends in troops. Shortly after Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, the Viet Cong began to attack bases where American advisors were stationed in South Vietnam. The attacks began in the fall of 1964 and continued to escalate. After a Viet Cong attack on a base in Pleiku in February 1965 left 7 Americans dead and more than 100 wounded, President Johnson decided to respond. Less than 14 hours after the attack, some 132 American aircraft struck North Vietnam. After the airstrikes, one poll showed that Johnson's approval rating on his handling of Vietnam jumped from 41% to 60%. The president's actions also met with strong approval from his closest advisors, including Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy. There were some dissenters in the White House, chief among them Undersecretary of State George Ball, who had earlier supported the president. He warned that if the United States got too deeply involved in Vietnam, it might become difficult to get out. "Once on the tiger's back," he warned, "we cannot be sure of picking the place to dismount." Most of the advisors who surrounded Johnson, however, firmly believed the nation had a duty to halt communism in Vietnam, both to maintain stability in Southeast Asia and to ensure the United States' continuing power and prestige in the world. In a memo to the president, Bundy argued, "The stakes in Vietnam are extremely high. The American investment is very large, and American responsibility is a fact of life, which is palpable in the atmosphere of Asia and even elsewhere. The international prestige of the U.S. and a substantial part of our influence are directly at risk in Vietnam." Quoted in The Best and the Brightest. In March 1965, Johnson expanded American involvement by shifting his policy to a sustained bombing campaign against North Vietnam. The campaign was named Operation Rolling Thunder. That month, the president also ordered the first combat troops into Vietnam. American soldiers were now fighting alongside the South Vietnamese troops against the Viet Cong. Reading check. Describing. How did politics play a role in President Johnson's Vietnam policy? A bloody stalemate emerges. By the end of 1965, more than 180,000 American combat troops were fighting in Vietnam. In 1966, that number doubled. Since the American military was extremely strong, it marched into Vietnam with great confidence. "America seemed omnipotent then," said Philip Caputo, one of the first Marines to arrive. "We saw ourselves as the champions of a cause that was destined to triumph." Frustrating warfare. Lacking the firepower of the Americans, the Viet Cong used ambushes, booby traps, and guerrilla tactics. Ronald J. Glasser, an American Army doctor, described the devastating effects of one booby trap. Three-quarters of the way through the tangle, a trooper brushed against a 2-inch vine, and a grenade slung at chest high went off, shattering the right side of his head and body. Nearby troopers took hold of the unconscious soldier and, half-carrying, half-dragging him, pulled him the rest of the way through the jungle. Quoted in Vietnam, A History. The Viet Cong also frustrated American troops by blending in with the general population in the cities and the countryside and then quickly vanishing. It was a sheer physical impossibility to keep the enemy from slipping away whenever he wished, one American general said. Journalist Linda Martin noted, "It's a war where nothing is ever quite certain and nowhere is ever quite safe." To counter the Viet Cong's tactics, American troops went on search-and-destroy missions. They tried to find enemy troops, bomb their positions, destroy their supply lines, and force them out into the open for combat. American forces also sought to take away the Viet Cong's ability to hide in the thick jungles by literally destroying the landscape. American planes dropped napalm, a jellied gasoline that explodes on contact. They also used Agent Orange, a chemical that strips leaves from trees and shrubs, turning farmland and forest into wasteland. A determined enemy. United States military leaders underestimated the Viet Cong's strength. They also misjudged the enemy's stamina. American generals believed that continuously bombing and killing large numbers of Viet Cong would destroy the enemy's morale and force them to give up. The guerrillas, however, had no intention of surrendering, and they were willing to accept huge losses in human lives. In the Viet Cong's war effort, North Vietnamese support was a major factor. Although the Viet Cong forces were made up of many South Vietnamese, North Vietnam provided arms, advisors, and significant leadership. Later in the war, as Viet Cong casualties mounted, North Vietnam began sending regular North Vietnamese army units to fight in South Vietnam. North Vietnam sent arms and supplies south by way of a network of jungle paths known as the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The trail wound through the countries of Cambodia and Laos, bypassing the border between North and South Vietnam. Because the trail passed through countries not directly involved in the war, President Johnson refused to allow a full-scale attack on the trail to shut it down. North Vietnam itself received military weapons and other support from the Soviet Union and China. One of the main reasons President Johnson refused to order a full-scale invasion of North Vietnam was his fear that such an attack would bring China into the war, as had happened in Korea. By placing limits on the war, however, Johnson made it very difficult to win. Instead of conquering enemy territory, American troops were forced to fight a war of attrition, a strategy of defeating the enemy forces by slowly wearing them down. This strategy led troops to conduct grisly body counts after battles to determine how many enemy soldiers had been killed. Bombing from American planes killed about 179,000 Vietnamese between 1965 and 1967. Nevertheless, the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese troops showed no sign of surrendering. Meanwhile, American casualties continued to mount. By the spring of 1966, more than 4,000 American soldiers had been killed. As the number of Americans killed and wounded continued to grow, the notion of a quick and decisive victory grew increasingly remote. As a result, many citizens back home began to question the nation's involvement in the war. Reading check. Describing. What tactics did the United States adopt to fight the Viet Cong? You're the historian. Incident in the Gulf of Tonkin. In 1963, the Viet Cong and South Vietnam were trying to topple the government and unite the country under communism. To prevent this, the United States had already committed money, supplies, and advisors. President Johnson asked Congress to authorize using force after reports that North Vietnam had made unprovoked attacks on U.S. warships in the Gulf of Tonkin. Congress responded with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Had the warship USS Maddox provoked the attack? Was Johnson fully informed of events in the Gulf? You're the historian. From accounts of an unprovoked attack. The sources advising President Johnson on the Gulf of Tonkin incident included the Navy and the Defense Department. These excerpts suggest how difficult it was to know what had happened, and also how tension influenced the American interpretation. U.S. Navy Commander John Herrick of the USS Maddox. I am being approached by high-speed craft with apparent intention of torpedo attack. I intend to open fire in self-defense if necessary. From a cable of August 2, 1964. U.S. Defense Department. While on routine patrol in international waters, the U.S. destroyer Maddox underwent an unprovoked attack by three PT-type boats in the Tonkin Gulf. The attacking boats launched three torpedoes and used 37-millimeter gunfire. The Maddox answered with 5-inch gunfire. The PT boats were driven off, with one seen to be badly damaged and not moving. No casualties or damage were sustained by the Maddox or the aircraft. From a press release of August 2, 1964. National Security Council meeting. Secretary McNamara. The North Vietnamese PT boats have continued their attacks on the two U.S. destroyers in international waters in the Gulf of Tonkin. Secretary Rusk. An immediate and direct action by us is necessary. The unprovoked attack on the high seas is an act of war for all practical purposes. CIA Director McCone. The proposed U.S. reprisals will result in sharp North Vietnamese military action, but such actions would not represent a deliberate decision to provoke or accept a major escalation of the Vietnamese War. President Johnson. Do they want a war by attacking our ships in the middle of the Gulf of Tonkin? U.S. Intelligence Agency Director Rowan. Do we know for a fact that the North Vietnamese provocation took place? Secretary McNamara. We will know definitely in the morning. August 2, 1964. Secretary Rusk. We believe that present O-Plan 34A activities are beginning to rattle Hanoi, capital of North Vietnam, and the Maddox incident is directly related to their efforts to resist these activities. We have no intention of yielding to pressure. From a top-secret telegram to Ambassador Maxwell Taylor, South Vietnam, August 3, 1964. From accounts of a possible mistake. 2 days after the alleged attack, the Turner Joy joined the Maddox in the Gulf. On the night of August 4, 1964, the two destroyers experienced a series of events they interpreted as a second attack. However, Commander Herrick later revised this report. President Johnson referred to the repeated attacks later when he asked Congress for war powers. Commander Herrick. Review of action makes many contacts and torpedoes fired appear doubtful. Freak weather effects on radar and overeager sonar men may have accounted for many reports. No actual visual sightings by Maddox. Suggest complete evaluation before any further action. Turner Joy also reports no actual visual sightings or wake. Entire action leaves many doubts except for apparent attempt to ambush at beginning. From two cables of August 4, 1964. President Johnson. The initial attack on the destroyer Maddox on August 2nd was repeated today by a number of hostile vessels attacking two U.S. destroyers with torpedoes. The destroyers and supporting aircraft acted at once on the orders I gave after the initial act of aggression. Repeated acts of violence against the armed forces of the United States must be met not only with alert defense, but with positive reply. In a television and radio address, August 4, 1964. In 1968, Senator William Fulbright opened an investigation into the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident. The following exchange took place between Senator Fulbright and Secretary McNamara. Secretary McNamara, I don't believe Commander Herrick in his cable stated that he had doubt that the attack took place. He questioned certain details of the attack. Secondly, his doubts were resolved that afternoon before the retaliatory action was taken. Senator Fulbright, I think he went further than that. He advised you not to do anything until it had been reevaluated. It is a very strong statement. Secretary McNamara, nothing was done until it was reevaluated. Senator Fulbright, he says, suggest complete reevaluation before any further action. Now, that is a very strong recommendation from a man on the scene in charge of the operation. Both committees, except for the senator from Oregon, Morse, unanimously accepted your testimony then as the whole story. And I must say, this raises very serious questions about how you make decisions to go to war.